This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At least 20 American troops and nearly 100 Iraqis have been killed since Sunday in central and southern Iraq. The insurgency continues in the Sunni Triangle, focused in and around the city of Fallujah, and now Shia militiamen are fighting coalition troops in Baghdad, in Kut, in Amara, and in Nasiriyah. These are forces loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who have shifted from protest to resistance over the past few days, opening a new front in the conflict. Still, Paul Bremer, the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, said today that despite these problems, much is going well in Iraq, and that the June 30th date for handing over power to an Iraqi government is still firm. This hour, the latest news from Iraq. We'll also talk with an expert about the internal politics among and within Iraq's religious and ethnic groups. And we'll check in, as we do from time to time, with an Iraqi-American imam from California to get his reaction to these troubling developments. If you have questions about the differences within Iraq's Shia community or about relations between the Shia leaders and U.S. officials, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now on the line from Baghdad is Anthony Shadid, a reporter for The Washington Post. And since we last spoke to you, you've been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for your reporting from Iraq. Congratulations, Anthony.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
What can you tell us about the fighting that's going on today in and around Fallujah?
Well, it's been a pretty fierce day across Iraq, and we've seen the Marines go deep into Fallujah today. This is the second or third day of the operation, and Marines there encountered quite a bit of fire coming from roofs, from doorways, from windows. It was mainly rifle fire, but it's mortars and rocket propelled grenades as well. Marines say that they've controlled much of the city, but they've pulled back later in the evening to fallback positions on closer to the edge of Fallujah.
Now, this is the area west of Baghdad and a little bit north as well on the Euphrates River. This is where four American military contractors were ambushed and murdered last week. And the U.S. Command took some care in arranging its response to that atrocity. Their charred bodies were dragged through the city. Some were hung from a bridge over the Euphrates. Any indication of what they're doing to try to rout out the perpetrators of that incident?
Well, we know that they actually have photographs of people believed responsible for the killing and mutilation of the contractors last week, and they're definitely going house to house, searching for weapons and searching for these suspects. You know, Fallujah is a tough city to deal with. It's been a center of unrest since after the war. And you've kind of seen a cycle of violence unfold there. There were quite a few deaths of protesters in the weeks after the war that led to attacks, which led to the military moving again. We just kind of see this play out over and over. So I think there is probably a pretty good risk that this may not be the end of the violence there.
Any idea of how long this may go on?
The military is not saying much about it at all. In fact, the only information coming out of Fallujah is from the handful of reporters embedded with the troops there. The military's kind of statement on this is that it's an ongoing operation, and they're not going to release too many details about it.
Now, then there are the troubles elsewhere in the country surrounding the developments regarding Muqtada al-Sadr and his followers. What can you tell us about him? For one thing, he moved today, did he not?
He did. He was... for a while, he was staying in or taking refuge in a mosque in Kufa, which is a pretty well-known mosque. It was the center. It was the mosque that his father had initially gained his following. Now, his father was a revered Ayatollah who was believed killed by Saddam Hussein's government in 1999. And Muqtada al-Sadr is one of the surviving sons. He's only 30 years old, but because of his father's prestige and popularity, he's inherited some of that support. And he's kind of catered to the more, you know, the poor and more disenfranchised in Iraq to both demand his militia, but also to, you know, many of his turn supporters in Baghdad or elsewhere.
Now, his supporters, as you suggest, I mean, he's based in the big area of the Shiite area of Baghdad in Sadr City, as it's now called, or Saddam City, as it used to be known in the old days. What kind of support does he have there? What about beyond his militiamen, who obviously are supporting? What do the regular people there say?
Far overshadowed by Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani. And I think the vast majority of Shiites look to Sistani as what they call the Mujah, which is the supreme religious authority in Iraq. That's what the say that Sutter doesn't enjoy some popular support, though. And as you pointed out, his stronghold is probably Baghdad, in the area known as Sutter City, which was named after his father after the war. And that's where I think most of his support comes. But he does have a sizable following in cities like Nasiriyah, Amara, Duaniya, Basra. You know, in part because of his militia and armed presence they have in those places, but also, like I said, there's a legacy of the following that his father enjoyed, you know, 5 or 6 years ago.
Now, as we mentioned earlier, he moved. He was at that mosque you were talking about, and has moved to Najaf?
That's right. He's moved to his office in Najaf. Now, his office is up the street from the Imam Ali Shrine, which is one of Shia Islam's most sacred sites. He's being well guarded. His militia men are in the streets, apparently. And, you know, it's pretty unlikely. His military has acknowledged that there would be a great risk in trying to get too close to the shrine or entering sites around the shrine, given their religious significance. So while they issued a warrant for his arrest, it's likely that any move against Nader will probably be carried out by Iraqi police or Iraqi soldiers.
Now, what can you tell us about this militia that Muqtada Sadr has developed, the Mahdi Army?
That's right. This is the Jaish al-Mahdi, which is named after a key Shia religious figure. It was formed in August, and at the time, it numbered probably 500 people. And a lot of people in Baghdad kind of ridiculed it for its ragtag quality. But in one sense, he and his followers have taken real efforts to turn it into much more of a force. And you know, estimates are all over the map on how many belong to the militia. You hear 3,000, you hear 6,000, you hear as many as 10,000. But they are armed. They have rifles as well as RPGs and mortars. And over the past 3 days, they've opened up another front, basically, against U.S. and allied troops. And a front that, you know, is of much more concern, I think, to U.S. military officials learning how to cope with it.
And obviously, the question still to be answered is whether they can sustain this activity.
That's right. It's actually a question on both sides. I mean, there's the question of whether the militia has the stomach for a fight that could go on for a while. They try to take over bridges, police posts, city council buildings. They've been forced out after a while, but they do hold several of those. Well, who they're facing, though, are not U.S. troops down in the south. They're facing multinational troops. And you do hear from people in the U.S. military that they don't think the multinational troops necessarily are being assertive in taking care of this challenge. So I think there's a question of, one, that the militia have the stomach for fight, two, are there enough multinational troops to take care of or to deal with the militia poses, and multinational troops also to restore security in a lot of these places.
Our guest is Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, TOTN@npr.org. And let's take a call from Imran, who joins us from Boston.
Hi. One thing I wanted to find out was whether the military is taking into account kind of the background of Shiism, and in that, I think my understanding is that Shias, they look at Imam Ali historically as a figure who was martyred and murdered by opponents. And kind of extrapolating that today, looking at Sadr, and if they try to arrest him or kill him, does that run the risk of creating the same type of martyr effect around the local community of Shias?
Yeah, that's a great observation, and I think it's really something that we really might see play out in the next few weeks and months. You know, the U.S. military is definitely treating this as an issue of one man, being Sadr, that he has an arrest warrant out for him, that they want to detain him, put him in front of an Iraqi judge. They're, like you pointed out, that there's a lot of history there, and Sadr already infuses his statements with religious imagery, with references to sacrifice and martyrdom. And there's a very big danger in Sadr being arrested and turning into a figure that, you know, just serves to rally more support. There's also, I think, you see in Iraq, there's an aversion to dealing too harshly with clerics, with men of religion. You know, it reminds me a lot of people here of Saddam's days when the clergy was decimated, people were arrested, executed, driven into exile. And this moving against the clergy, even clergy that aren't necessarily overwhelmingly popular, there's a danger of conflating the attack on the man with an attack on religion.
Imran, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Anthony Shadid, again, congratulations on winning the Pulitzer Prize, and thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid is a reporter for The Washington Post. He joined us on the phone from Baghdad. And with us now is Fawaz Gerges. He's chair of the Middle East Studies and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College, author of the forthcoming book, The Islamists and the West. He's at our bureau in New York. And welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Neil.
As we look at this confrontation that's now developed between the United States and the forces of Muqtada al-Sadr, remind us, this began, it was involved, as I understand it, the closure of a newspaper that was one of al-Sadr's newspapers, but also the arrest of one of his aides, and that going back to a murder last year, almost a year ago, of another Shiite cleric.
Yes, I think the decision by Paul Bremer to shut down the pro-Al-Sadr newspaper, it's called Al-Huza Al-Natiqa, I think it was a very reckless decision. I think regardless of how awful was the newspaper, how unpleasant it was for the U.S. authorities, I think there is the question first of the freedom of press. And of course, Neil, the complex realities of Iraqi politics and also religious sentiments wouldn't have been better to put up with an unpleasant newspaper than to shut it down and at least unleashed the anger of al-Sadr's followers. And yes, of course, now we are told there is a warrant for al-Sadr himself, who allegedly participated in the murder of the prominent Shia cleric last year, al-Khoui. Well, it's a bit, quite very ironic that now the confrontation has escalated between, the coalition forces and al-Sadr. We are now told about the warrant. And I think this is really raises many questions about, I think, the wisdom of the coalition authorities to at least escalate the confrontation with al-Sadr, not only by shutting down his newspaper, the unpleasant newspaper, but also by arresting one of his senior clerics, al-Yaqubi, last week. And I think, unfortunately now, it seems to me, it's an open confrontation between U.S. forces and the followers of al-Sadr.
Is this, you say it's an open confrontation, and it certainly appears to be that way, yet just a couple of months before what's supposed to be a transfer of power, what made it impossible for al-Sadr to wait?
Well, I think al-Sadr, from the beginning, by the way, from day one, I think of all the religious clerics in Iraq, he has been one of the most transparent and forthcoming. I think from day one, he has made it very clear that he is politically very ambitious. He has been a consistent and steady voice in opposing the American occupation in Iraq. And I think, unlike Ali Sistani, one of the most prominent Shiite clerics in Iraq, he has made it very clear that clerics should play a direct and active role in the political process. And I think if you listen to, the narrative put on the table by the American authorities, they think or they argue that it's al-Sadr who basically opened a front against the American forces and against the Iraqi authorities. Yet, from where al-Sadr stands, according to his own narrative, is that by shutting down his newspaper, by arresting his senior cleric al-Yaqubi, by putting pressure on his own constituency, I think they have opened a second front against al-Sadr and his militia.
So mutual misunderstanding, perhaps.
Absolutely. And I think what we need to understand, Neil, here, I think the caller raised a highly critical point, and I think Anthony's response was just brilliant. I think it's quite easy to arrest al-Sadr, but the question is, I don't believe that cracking down and arresting al-Sadr will likely silence his zealous followers. In fact, I would argue arresting al-Sadr will likely drive thousands of young Shiites to militarily resist the American occupation. It's not in America's interest to really escalate the confrontation against al-Sadr.
Our guest is Fawaz Gerges. When we come back from a break, we'll also be joined by Imam Sayed Mustafa al-Kazwini as we continue to talk about the latest news from Iraq. Join us, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the new front in Iraq as fighting spreads between coalition forces and followers of a radical Shiite cleric. Our guest is Fawaz Jerjes, Chair of Middle Eastern Studies and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College. If you have questions, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address, totn@npr.org. And before the break, Fawaz Jerjes, you were talking about the difficulty American forces might face if they would arrest Muqtada al-Sadr, who's moved, as Anthony Shadid told us a little bit earlier in the program, from a mosque south of Baghdad to his office in Najaf. Does moving from the mosque to an office, a more secular place, would that make it easier for American forces to exercise this warrant?
Neil, a footnote. He moved to Najaf, which has, I mean, his office is facing the mosque of Ali, one of the most, I suppose, worshipped and respected Shiite saint. So I think Najaf is a highly sacred place for the Shiites. And here I want to come back to the earlier point I was trying to make about the political consequences of arresting al-Sadr. I think the United States not only does not really have the resources to open a second front, but I think the United States, in particular the U.S. authorities in Iraq, are taking a huge gamble on the fact that the Shiite community will distance itself from al-Sadr if the confrontation escalates. I think, Neil, this is a huge gamble. It's a huge gamble because we need to understand the religious sensibilities of the Shiite community. When Shiite blood is spilled, I expect Shiite leaders to close ranks. Let's remember, I mean, I think escalating the confrontation against al-Sadr and his Shiite followers will likely deepen the sense of victimization within the Shiite community. And I think that is a very important here to remind our viewers that the Shiite community feels a deep sense of victimization because of the, of course, murder of their saints, and then, of course, because of their repression under Saddam Hussein. And now here you have the occupying force doing the same thing to their leaders as Saddam Hussein did. And I think by deepening the sense of victimization, I fear that the escalating the military confrontation against al-Sadr, I think it could produce the opposite results from the intended consequences by motivating thousands of young Shiites to militarily resist the U.S. occupation. There is no military solution to this particular confrontation. And regardless of how unpleasant al-Sadr is, I think dialogue and a political solution must be found to this particular deadly embrace.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Sam joins us on the line from College Park, Maryland.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I'm a subscriber to The Washington Post, and I've read a lot of what Mr. Shadid has written for the past year. And al-Sadr, he's been writing about him ever since the war ended. And the rest of the media just recently picked up on what he's been writing, so I think his Pulitzer is well-deserved. And I wanted to ask a question about the sort of rivalry between al-Sadr and Sistani, and whether Sistani could have, like, a pacifying force, or whether he'd be willing to sort of rebuke al-Sadr, and whether his relationship with us, whether he'd be pragmatic and want to sort of cooperate with us.
That's the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. Fawaz Jerjes?
Well, I think this is a highly critical question. I don't think the Shiite community acts like a crowd. It acts like one block. I think the Shiite community is deeply divided. And I think there is a rivalry between the most prominent Shiite cleric in Iraq, Ali Sistani, and the young, fiery, militant cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr. And I think we know last year their followers clashed several times. And, Neil, we know that Sistani and al-Sadr are not even on talking terms because of their rivalry, political rivalry. And also what we need to remember, there is a basic conceptual divide between the two. Sistani does not believe that religious clerics should play a direct and active role in the political process, while Muqtada al-Sadr believes that clerics must play a direct and active role. And yet it's ironic, when the confrontation began a few 2 days ago, Sistani basically came out and condemned the attacks against the Shiites, and he has not been willing to come out and condemn the uprising by al-Sadr's militia. And this tells you, about the internal dynamics of the Shiite community, even though there are some major divisions between Assadr's followers and Sistani. When the chips are down, I expect Shiite leaders to be very careful to condemn each other.
Sam, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Joining us now on the line from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, is Imam Syed Mustafa Al-Kazwini. He's Imam at the Islamic Education Center of Orange County in California in Florida for a lecture there this evening. And Imam, welcome back to the program as always.
My pleasure to be with you, Neil.
What's been the reaction of Iraqi Americans to these skirmishes between al-Sadr's followers and U.S. troops? What's this latest development?
Obviously, all of us are shocked and sad for what is happening in Iraq. In fact, we were preparing ourselves to celebrate the first anniversary of the downfall of the dictator regime in Iraq. But unfortunately, what we are seeing today is the escalation of tension and war, and it could be a minor civil war. So we are very, very extremely worried about what's happening. People are contacting their relatives to find out about what's happening, and it's a very awkward situation here.
We should mention that the Shia cleric whom Muqtada al-Sadr is accused now of having killed is your relative.
Yes, a distant relative, unfortunately, Sayyid Abdul Majid al-Khoi, who was murdered a year ago. But we really cannot say for sure that Muqtada al-Sadr was involved in this. We cannot say that. We have no evidence. The perpetrators have not been brought to trial. So we really cannot judge about that. We have no solid foundation for that. We wish that one day they will be brought to trial and to see who were the people behind this this crime.
You sound as if you're being skeptical about these charges.
Yes, indeed, because unfortunately, 1 year after the change of regime in Iraq, still we don't have a judiciary system there, we don't have a government there, we don't have a proper way of dealing with all these problems. And I myself very frustrated about what's happening in Iraq, the way the American forces in Iraq dealing with Muqtada al-Sadr. I don't think this is a very proper way during this very critical time when we are prepared to transfer the power to the Iraqi people. I disagree with the warrant issued against him. I think the timing of it is very wrong. We should deal that with diplomacy, with dialogue, not with violence and confrontation.
How is Sadr viewed amongst Iraqi Americans or the people that you know?
Can you repeat that, please?
How is Sadr viewed in your community?
Well, maybe most of the members of the community here in America, they do not relate to Muqtada al-Sadr. But the fact that in Iraq there is a considerable number of he has a considerable number of followers there, even those who not necessarily agree with him, when it comes to such confrontation, I think they will be sided with him to vent their frustration at the lack of security, at the lack of basic necessities in Iraq. So I think he caters to the inspiration of some of the Iraqi now.
Now, you have met on your, I think, your most recent trip to Iraq with the Grand Ayatollah Sistani. When we were talking earlier with Fawaz Gerges, and he has declined to condemn Sadr's followers for their actions today. Could you speculate as to why?
Yes, indeed, he would decline, and I don't think one day he will criticize or condemn Muqtada al-Sadr. This is a very, very sensitive issue because it is a confrontation between an Iraqi religious leader and a foreign entity, an occupier, and I don't think that it is wise for Ayatollah Sistani, who represents the majority of the Shias in Iraq and worldwide, to come and condemn a person who's who has popularity within the Iraqis, and he's speaking on behalf of some of them at this moment. I don't think the Sistani will do that.
What do you read into the decision by Muqtada al-Sadr to move to his office in Najaf? What does that mean?
I think to avoid the bloodshed in case of, if he is attacked or if the coalition forces are going to arrest him, being in such a sacred place will really lead to a huge number of casualties. Considering that it is a season of pilgrimage nowadays in Iraq, it is, we are approaching the 40th of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet. So I think he wanted to avoid bloodshed, and therefore maybe he would be more secure in his office, in his place.
Would he also, might not he also be setting himself up as a rival to the Grand Ayatollah Sistani?
He looks at himself as a rival. He looks at himself as a legitimate leader for the Iraqis, being born in Iraq, coming from such a prominent family as al-Sadr, who has produced many philosophers, scholars, such as Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, who was killed by the regime back in the 80s, such as his father, who was assassinated back in 1999. I think he looks at himself as the most qualified spiritual leader in Iraq today. And he sometimes looks at others as foreigners who just came to Iraq, stayed there. But that is not the case, in fact, in Iraq. I think Sistani, he dominates, the country with his leadership. But, of course, Muqtada al-Sadr, during this time, he caters to the aspirations of some of the Iraqis. That's why they are listening to him and obeying his commands.
Imam, thank you so much for your time today, as always.
Thank you, Neil.
Syed Mustafa Al-Kazwini is Imam at the Islamic Education Center of Orange, California, Orange County, California. He was with us today by phone from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where he's making an appearance later tonight. We're still with us is Fawaz Gerges, the Chair of Middle Eastern Studies and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College in New York, and he's at our bureau in New York. And as you listen to the Imam talk there about the position of these two men relative to each other, I wondered what you made of his comments about the possibility that al-Sadr might be setting himself up as a rival to Sistani.
I think Imam Qazwini raised some really critical points, and I would like to go over some of them, but please, I mean, stop me, Neil, if I go on and on. I think what we need to understand, just for our American readers, is that regionalism and ethnicity are very important in today's Iraq. Let's not underestimate the fact that Ali al-Sistani is a Persian Shi'at cleric, while al-Sadr is very proud of his Arab heritage. Al-Sadr is an Arab Shi'at. Al-Sistani has Persian roots. There's an implicit current of criticism of al-Sistani, particularly within the Sunni community. Some of them say, how could al-Sistani represent Iraq and Iraqis? After all, he is a Persian, he's not an Iraqi. And in this particular sense, I think al-Sadr looks at himself as a proud Shi'at Arab, qualified and equipped to lead Iraq, Iraqis, and the Shi'ats in particular. And ironically, Neil, unlike al-Sistani, who basically has really built up his reputation as a leader of the Shi'ats, al-Sadr would like to come across, who he portray himself as an Iraqi leader representing not just the Shi'ats, but also the Sunnis as well. And it's I can't tell you how much he is respected within the Sunni community, mm-hmm. not just the Shi'at community. It tells you about his ability to build bridges to the, hardcore Sunni constituency in Iraq today. This is point one. But the big question is, what are the sources of his power within the Shia community? This is really the critical question. Because if you listen to the official version of Paul Bremer and U.S. authority, they tell you he's an outlaw, he's a nobody, he does not really represent a major constituency in Iraq. Well, you know, that is a very simplistic, thinking. Why? I think there are three sources of at least important aspects we need to focus on. I think Muqtada al-Sadr as Imam Qazwini said, has inherited a prominent religious legacy. After all, he is the son of one of the most senior respected ayatollahs.
And I hate to interrupt you, but I do have to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And please continue. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Who, Neil, in 1999 was killed along with his two sons by allegedly by the former Ba'athist regimes. And I think this particular religious legacy, coupled with the martyrdom of his family, I think endears Muqtada Sadr in the eyes of many Shiites, not just his followers or his members of the Mahdi army. And I think here, I don't think we should at least dismiss lightly his, at least the way he is perceived within the Shiite community. This is one source of his power. Next, I think what we need to understand is that Asadr is a young, fiery, charismatic leader who has a militant temperament, which appeals to young, disenfranchised Iraqis, particularly in the poor quarters of Asadr city. Asadr city, Neil, has more than 1.5 million citizens, mostly Shiites. It used to be called Saddam Hussein city. Mm-hmm. And after the fall of Saddam Hussein, it was named Asadr city. And I think he has his major power base lies in Asadr city. And I think what we need to understand here is that Asadr and his cleric aides have established an impressive social base among those disfranchised Iraqis and have been able to provide humble but important social services to thousands of poor Shiites. Again here, I would warn the U.S. administration that they should not underestimate the importance of Asadr's social base, which is infused with both religious fervor and legitimacy and nourished on face-to-face network of social services. Unemployment, Neil, in Asadr city tops 80%.
Unemployment, you're talking about.
Absolutely. 80%. Poverty is very endemic. So you can imagine you have, tens of thousands of young men who are basically given social services and support by Asadr and his religious associates and aides. And finally, I think what we need to understand about Asadr is that I think his radical political views appeal to a critical constituency within the Shiite community. As I said earlier, he has been a consistent and steady voice in opposing the American occupation. And of course, if left to his own devices, he would like to execute former Ba'athists without even having a trial. Mm-hmm. So the three sources of power really explain the importance of Asadr within the Shiite community.
When we come back from a short break, we'll wrap up our conversation with Fawaz Jerjes and take another call on the situation currently in Iraq. We'll also be talking about developments in Haiti and bringing you up to date on the chickens of Key West. So stay tuned. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the crisis in Iraq, where forces loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr, a Shiite cleric based in Baghdad, have opened a new front in the insurgency against U.S. and coalition forces, attacking coalition forces in four cities across central and southern Iraq today. Our guest is Fawaz Jerjes, a chair of Middle Eastern Studies and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College. He's in our bureau in New York. And let's get another caller on the line. And Hussein is with us from Miami, Florida.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, the situation in Iraq in the last week sort of reminds me of the Israeli invasion of South Lebanon. I'm a Shiite Lebanese. And when the Israelis came in, the Shiites basically welcomed the Israelis in because they were going to get rid of the Palestinians. And lo and behold, because of the brutality and just the absolute brutishness of the Israeli army, the Shiites turned against the Israelis pretty soon. And this is what's happening now. My great-late uncle, who's also a Shia, used to rail against the Iranians. The Iranian clergy, because they are picking up arms, and we as Shias are supposed to bear and tolerate injustice until our, let me borrow a Christian term, our Messiah, our Mahdi comes. But it seems like American foreign policy is incapable of sort of distinguishing between sects and between political views and wants to brush everybody in the same brushstroke. Is that true or not, Professor Jerjes?
Well, I think you're really putting on the table a highly critical footnote. It's really ironic that the Israeli invasion of Lebanon was initially welcomed by the majority of the Shiite community, yet the heavy-handed tactics of the Israeli army created Hezbollah. Hezbollah did not exist, Neil, before the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And in fact, in many ways, when Muqtada Sadr speaks today, he reminds me of Hassan Nasrallah. Hassan Nasrallah is the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah. And I think I worry very much that I think there is really little understanding of the complex dynamics of the Shiite community and the deep sense of victimization and how cohesive the community is. And I fear that if we escalate, I'm talking about the Americans, the confrontation in Iraq, I fear that we could create the same symbol. We can make Muqtada Sadr another Hassan Nasrallah, and another Hezbollah could be created in Iraq.
Do you think, Fawaz Jerjes, that this situation would change after the transfer of sovereignty, which we're told is still going to go ahead on June the 30th, if Shias have a more a greater stake in the government of Iraq? It's not going to be elected, of course, but if they have a greater stake.
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, let's remember, Neil, here. We talk about Muqtada Sadr as if the Shiite community, the main Shiite community, is satisfied with the current conditions in Iraq. That's really, it cannot be further from the truth. Let's remember, Neil, that Ali Sistani, the mainstream Shiite cleric, has been, again, a consistent critical voice of the direction in which Paul Bremer is leading Iraq to. Mm-hmm. In particular, he's been very critical of the constitution, the interim constitutions, which gives the Iraqi minorities, the Sunni Arabs and the Kurds, a veto over the decisions by the majority. So I think what you need to understand, I think there's a great deal of dissatisfaction within the Shiite community. And yes, if, I suppose, when American forces leave Iraq, and if a legitimate authority takes hold in Iraq, I'm sure if the Shiites are empowered, they would be delighted. But the danger lies in the fact that there is no legitimate political authority now. To whom are you going to transfer power in the first place? Let's remember that the American forces have not been able to provide security for Iraqis and even for themselves. And since the capture of the Iraqi president Saddam Hussein, I mean, a drumbeat of attacks continue. Hundreds of American and Iraqi lives have been wasted since the capture of Saddam Hussein, and it tells me that the security situation is deteriorating considerably, and we still, the political process is really in a stalemate. So again, to whom are you going to transfer power to? And we know, Neil, that the Iraqi Governing Council, the hand-picked Iraqi Governing Council, lacks legitimacy in the eyes of most Iraqis. So you don't only have a security problem, you have a political problem as well. To whom are you going to transfer power to at the end of June?
Hussein, thanks very much for the call.
Well, can I make another comment?
If you could keep it very quickly.
Very quickly. I think it's ironic that last year Donald Rumsfeld categorized the riots that were happening as being stuff happens. But now the same riots that are happening in Fallujah, granted that they are for Americans, and that's precisely why that now Donald Rumsfeld is not categorizing them as stuff happens. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Hussein. And Fawaz Jerjes, thanks as always for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure.
Fawaz Jerjes is Chair of Middle Eastern Studies and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College. He was with us from our bureau in New York.